Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is the New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci, and he is out with his new Atlee Pine thriller. This one is called Daylight. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. David, this book essentially is like watching the next episode of a television series because it picks up almost exactly where the previous book ended up, and the overarching theme is Atlee searching for her sister who was kidnapped years and years ago. Can you kind of jumpstart us into this book and where the previous book left off?
Yeah, so at the end of A Minute to Midnight, Atlee had learned some things about her twin sister, Mercy, and revelations about her own past that she didn't know. And taking that information forward, she heads to New Jersey, where she thinks she might be able to find out something about the man who kidnapped her sister all those years ago by talking to members of his family.
Atlee works...
In the very first chapter, she literally runs into another series character of mine, John Puller, an Army CID agent. He's investigating a crime at Fort Dix in New Jersey that involves the guy that Atlee Pine wants to talk to. And so they get involved in his investigation at the same time that Puller actually helps Atlee Pine on her investigation trying to find her sister. And I love bringing, you know, series characters together. I did that in Walk the Wire with Amos Decker and Will Robey. It sort of gives the readers kind of a two bangs for the buck. And it made perfect sense because she was talking to people who were involved in the military, and that's John Puller's world. So it was kind of nice to bring them back, and I hadn't really visited with Puller in a long time. I know it sounds like he's a real person, and he kind of is to me, but I think the fans will enjoy seeing him again.
Well, Atlee works for the FBI, and yet she's investigating her sister's disappearance. How is it she gets this leave from the FBI to do that? Because it seems counterintuitive that, you know, take care of your own personal business on your own time.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And here are a couple of reasons. One, that... She's had a great career at the FBI. She's a stellar agent. They want to keep her, obviously. She's got a lot of problems and baggage with her sister, and that has affected her work at the FBI. And her boss at the FBI sort of laid down the law for her to say, look, you've got some problems. You got to fix them. If you don't fix them, then really you don't have a future at the FBI. I'm going to give you some leave time to get this straight because you're a good agent. I want to keep you. But it's a limited period of time, and if you don't get it done, and if you can't fix the problem, then you don't have a future at the FBI. So really it's laid down sort of the law to her. But at the same time, like in A Minute to Midnight, she did solve, you know, a mystery of a killer, a series of killings down in Georgia. And, you know, that allowed her a little bit more leeway with the FBI because she had done such a good job. And again, they don't want to lose her. She's a terrific agent. She's the best agent they have, certainly out west, and that's her bailiwick out there near the Grand Canyon. But you're right, it's only a limited period of time. It's not like she can spend months on this. She has to get it wrapped up.
Something I thought was interesting is the dynamics between the investigation of Atlee as an FBI agent and John Puller as CID. Can you kind of explain how the two work sort of similarly, but they have different ways that they investigate?
Yeah, the military and civilian life is very, very different. I think the FBI is a complex organization. There's nobody that out-complicates the American military system. It's the most complicated beast on earth. And there are lots of rules that may seem very foreign to people who are not used to that life. And, you know, they have a partnership in this novel because they have to, and they're good friends. They worked an investigation before, something I'd foreshadowed in the previous book. But at the same time, they butt heads occasionally from time to time. You know, Puller is used to being in charge. When he says something, you know, makes an order, it's done. That's not Pine's world. You know, nobody really orders her around who's not in her chain of command. They work well together, but sometimes it's an unwieldy balance, and I show that during the course of the investigation. You know, Puller really has a very strict chain of command. Pine has a lot more latitude, particularly since she's investigating something very personal to her that's outside of any official FBI investigation. So she has a little more flexibility than Puller does. And he's kind of a by-the-book kind of guy. So there's a little bit of friction between the two.
There are certain things that you touch on, little aspects of sociology in today's world throughout the book, and I'm not giving anything away, but you touch on drug abuse, and you touch on Alzheimer's disease, and I've noticed that you do sprinkle these things throughout your books, especially with Alzheimer's. How important is that issue to you that you chose to include that as a piece of this book?
It's very important. I don't think anybody living today has not been touched by someone who's had, you know, early onset dementia, Alzheimer's. It's just so pervasive in our society now. And I think, you know, as people get older, they all worry about that. And it used to be, well, you know, I'll just keep my mind active and I'll never get it, because that's the only reason you get it, is because you don't let your mind sort of go. And now we've come to learn a lot more about it. You know, there are chemical imbalances, protein buildup, lesions in the brain that, you know, no matter how much you read or keep your mind engaged, those things can still happen. And I think people have, you know, an understandable fear of, I don't want to spend my golden years not slowly, you know, my mind disintegrating. I don't recognize my loved ones. I can't have a full life anymore. But my sort of solution, not a solution, but at least one way of looking at it is, I think information is powerful, and the more information you have is important. So to focus on an issue like that so that people can go out and learn more about it, I think is important, and that's why I kind of sprinkle those things in. The same thing with substance abuse. I don't think, you know, most people know somebody, because it's also very pervasive in life. You know, right now we're sort of in the midst of the drugs of despair through the Rust Belt and other parts of America, where people have lost jobs and economies have been ruined, and people turn to these drugs because, you know, they've lost everything, and that's, they're in despair. And these drugs are heavily, heavily, you know, once you get hooked, you take one dose and you're totally hooked on these types of drugs. They're so powerful these days, particularly the synthetic opioids. And it's something that needs to be addressed. It's part of American life right now, and we can't not confront it. If we don't confront it, we can never solve it.
You mentioned that nobody outcomplicates the military, and I would argue that there's no novelist working today that understands the inner workings of the federal government more than you to create a story, because you kind of understand this alphabet soup of the different agencies and things that go on. But as you peel back the onion layer and peel back the skin on these onions and you start looking at this, it reminds me of Shawshank Redemption, where Andy Dufresne made a comment that the system's not easy, it's something like the system's not easy to con if you know where all the kinks are. You seem to find those little kinks in the federal government where you can have corruption, where you can have bad actors. And is that something that shocked you as to how easily that fits into a narrative and makes it somewhat believable?
Yeah, you know, as I've gotten older, I've become less and less shocked. I think that any organization is only as strong as its weakest link. It's sort of cliche, but nonetheless true. I also think that the bigger and more unwieldy and far-flung organization you have, human beings are human beings, and most people do their job, and they do it well, and they're honest, and they want to do a good job. But it doesn't take much for somebody who has a little bit of the knowledge of the inner workings of the federal government to find the weaknesses, because a beast as big as that, you're going to have an array of weaknesses that people can exploit. You're going to have sometimes a lack of oversight. Sometimes people are overburdened. They have too much to do, so they can't check on things like they used to. And people can take advantage of it, because one thing never changes during the course of all of this time, and that human beings don't change. And some human beings are, you know, their mindset is to take advantage of the system, not to work within it, and to take advantage of it in a way that will personally benefit them. Human people like that have always been around, they will always be around, and they will always take advantage.
Something else I noticed in the book is that we hear this term deep state thrown around all the time and in a political sense, but it seems like you kind of like to flip that on the head and show that there's deep state in both the political parts of the government and the career parts of the government. And is that something you did consciously?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. You know, we live, unfortunately, now in a world of conspiracy theories and alternate realities and social media platforms that if you go on some of these sites, you just lose faith in the fact that humanity can survive. Just the stuff that you read is just beyond the pale. But I also know people who are intelligent, well educated, seemingly, you know, normal in their outlooks, who believe a lot of this stuff. And it makes you, if you have to understand human psychology, you understand that no matter how well-educated or, you know, well-traveled and how broad your societal perspective is, anybody can be duped if they're hit with this stuff at the right time and they're in a vulnerable position. So this idea of the deep state and this huge cabals of people, you know, conspiring and all that, I won't say that there aren't people out there pushing their agendas and trying to make sure they have maximum power. That's just politics. That's just the way the world works. And are there millions of, you know, people who work for the federal government who are somehow banded together to do really bad things? No, they're not. Are there individuals strewn throughout the government and also through civilian life, through private business, through capitalist organizations that are trying to do that? Absolutely. Some of them, that's how they make their living. you know. And so, you know, we have a whole army of people in politics that their job is to make you believe what they're saying is true. And however they can rationalize it, they will. However they can get the message out, they will. And they're paid very well to make you believe that, you know, their opinion is the right one and you should vote a certain way. That's always been with us. I think what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years because of the social media platforms, it's accelerated from 60 miles an hour to 6,000 miles an hour. And now I can be one person spewing these conspiracy theories, and I have a, whereas before, you know, I might reach a few dozen people. Now I can go on Twitter or Parler or Facebook or fill in the blank social media platform, and I can reach millions of people within very few seconds, and they in turn can amplify my message onward, and that happens every day, unfortunately.
I'm chatting with New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci about his new book, Daylight. It is his latest Atlee Pine thriller, and the book's available now. David, something that I noticed in the book is there's a lot of sadness in this book, and you really humanize both Army CID and FBI agents and the families that they have to deal with. And I think that's something that doesn't come across in a medium when we watch this in a movie or a television show, but you really take pains to humanize these folks, and not only the humanity that they have, but in dealing with people that they encounter, victims of crime, families of victims of crime. Why does that stand out to you as something that you need to investigate and to at least explore for the reader?
I think that's probably one of the most important points in writing a book like this. I could just write a thriller where there's nonstop action and people fall like dominoes and you don't give any name, you don't put a name to the victim. And for me, what would be the point of that? Because I want to make sure that when people understand that bad things happen to people, I want to know, you know, I want you to know their name, rank, and serial number, meaning I want you to know their history, how it happened, why it happened, and what the effect it had on their friends and family. Because when something bad happens to somebody, it just doesn't happen to them. It happens to everybody who knew them, everybody who loved them, everybody who cared for them. And I think, you know, writing mysteries and thrillers doesn't absolve me of the you know, the requirement that I point that out. And for me, I'm a very caring person. You know, I think I can always tell, you know, if somebody's a really good person that they have pets, they have animals, they love dogs, they love cats, because that just shows a compassion and a connection with other, you know, living things that are just sort of paramount. And I have that in my life, and I have that in my writing, because I always look at the effect that a bad act has on people and all the people that care for that person. And I try to write about that deeply in my books. I think it's important, because otherwise, what does it matter? I could have 100 people die in a book, and if I don't tell you about who they are and who are mourning them, then what's the point of doing, you know, having all these deaths other than just killing people? Then it just becomes a cartoon. So for me, when bad things happen, I explain the effect it has on lots of people, because you know what? That's what happens in real life as well. And we see that day and day and day, so why should it be any different in fiction?
The thing I've also noticed is Atlee Pine never dictates any reports, and maybe that's the boring stuff you don't show, but the amount of paperwork, I mean, she would rival a thriller writer for the amount of reports that she would generate from all she's doing, right?
Oh, she absolutely would. I mean, yeah, the Bureau, like many other, you know, law enforcement organizations, are absolutely buried in paper or buried in digital reports now. And she's not the exception to that. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I could definitely write about that and put it in there. I don't, just because it kind of slows down the story. But the FBI is a hierarchy, you know, and you got layers and layers of people between you and the top, and everybody has to follow the reports, and everybody has to know, you know, what the other person is doing. And a lot of times, so the supervisor can say, you know, okay, how many, you know, people have you questioned this week? How many arrests have you made? How many convictions have you gotten? How many times have you testified in court? That's the mundane stuff behind the FBI, but it also absolutely represents, you know, how effective they are. And, you know, I let that sort of slide in the background because it's not the most exciting thing to write about, but it's a big part of every FBI agent's life.
Are you getting to the end now of books that can be written pre-pandemic, pre-COVID, where we have to take into account just the way our life is now, social distancing and things? Because this book is obviously set before the pandemic hit.
Yeah, it is. It may very well be kind of the last one, because I didn't touch on the pandemic at all. I think that people are living in every second of their lives, and the last thing you want to do when you open a book is to be, you know, reminded of the fact that we're living in a very different world. You know, so long as, you know, hopefully we, with the vaccines coming through, and it looks like we have a couple of promising candidates, that maybe we can get beyond this. It's not going to happen rapidly. As I've been having discussions with lots of people, they're like, oh my God, the vaccine's coming, I can just go out to dinner now. And I'm like, no. A vaccine is preventative. You know, so if you already have it, it's not like they're giving this vaccine to people who are on ventilators in hospitals. It won't help them. It's to prevent you from getting it. And keep in mind that we have a flu vaccine. People still get the flu every year, and people still die from the flu every year. So people still continue to die from COVID every year, even though we have a vaccine. But so I'm really torn about that. Even going forward, I'm not sure if I want to talk about the virus or have people social distance or have Atlee Pine or Amos Decker being wearing a mask. I don't know what I'm going to do about that right now, and I think I'm probably not alone in the writer world about that. I'm sure a lot of writers are having sort of facing that same conundrum.
Well, do you find that people demand more accuracy in their fiction than they do in a lot of their government leaders? Because I can see writers writing to you and say, oh, Atlee Pine would be wearing a mask in this thing. This would never happen, that type of thing, even though the whole point of yours is fiction and to get people out of the real world.
I've been in this business a long time. I never will put past anything what people would send me emails about. It could be the smallest thing, but you know what? It's important to them, and I respect their opinions, and they certainly have the right to voice that opinion, and they can. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, if a reply is given, I don't reply to everybody anymore these days. There's too many of them. But I try to point out that it is fiction, and I can set the ground rules for it. And if I don't want to, you know, write about people wearing masks all over the place, even though we're in the middle of a pandemic, then I can do that. And by the way, you know, the pandemic is in real life, and you're facing it every day. And I thought books like this represented some escapism. So you can't have escapism that I plop you right down in the world of COVID again. So it's an unwieldy balance. I'm not saying my answer is right or wrong, and I'm not saying what the best path forward is. I'm just saying that, you know, it's something we have to think about, and every writer has to make their own decision.
I find myself continually falling in love over and over again with Carol Bloom, Atlee Pine's assistant, kind of a grandmotherly figure, and really somebody that probably goes beyond what she should be doing as an FBI agent, or as an FBI employee. She's a clerical employee. But as you write her, and have you kind of felt that gradual nudge that she has, that Atlee really inspires her to do more than just file paperwork?
Absolutely. I think they're really good for each other. I mean, she represents sort of the mom or grandmother that Atlee never had, sort of that maternal, you know, sort of instinct and guiding hand, which has been very helpful. And you see that in subtle touches throughout the books where Carol sort of plays that role. But at the same time, Carol, who I think is overqualified for the role of administrative assistant and has a lot of really good investigative instinctual tendencies, gives her the time to shine. It allows her to go out there and show people what she can do and talents that she had that were sort of wasted sitting behind a desk, you know, filing reports. And the other thing you have to keep in mind is that over the course of her nearly 40 years at the FBI, she's seen everything. She's seen good agents, bad agents, mediocre agents. She's seen investigations that were successful and ones that failed, and she knows all the secrets and why they did and why they didn't. And that really is a powerful tool. And so allowing her to go out and sort of be part of an investigation, I think, is one of the coolest aspects of the entire series.
Who makes the decision for you as a writer? Is it a collaboration that your next novel is going to be another Atlee Pine, or it's going to be a John Polar? Who makes that decision that this is what you're going with next?
Yeah, it's totally me. You know, my publisher is totally hands-off. They're at the point now after, you know, 25 years of this and over almost 50 books that whatever you send us, we'll be fine with, which is kind of nice. That wasn't always the case. But I have to think about it methodically, too, about I can't, if I'm writing a series like Atlee Pine that is, you know, has a lot of stuff that's very timely and things are happening, then I can't wait 2 years to bring another book out because the readers will have a disconnect. You know, it's been 2 years since they read it. They might have forgotten a lot about what happened in the previous books. And the whole effect will be diminished because of that. So the timing of the stories and the connection with that to the reader's perception and sort of, you know, how much knowledge they will continue to hold plays a big part. So I have to be cognizant of that, too. I mean, it seems like that would be the last thing a writer should think about when they're putting a story together. But when you're doing a series, pragmatically, you kind of have to. And then the other thing I think about is what characters have I not revisited that I'd like to spend time with. I'd love bringing John Polar back in this novel. It's been a few years since I wrote a John Polar novel, and sort of bring him back and get back into the world of the military was a great thing. I just loved it. I pulled out my old reference books and all my old research and stuff and sort of immersed myself in that world again, and it was a really cool feeling. I found that I had missed the guy, so sometimes it's as simple as that.
And I'm sure your research on the military is 40,000 pages that you have to condense into 5 paragraphs in the book, right?
It absolutely is. I mean, I remember my first John Polar, the Zero Day. He had to defuse a nuclear weapon. There's really no way to defuse a nuclear weapon. It's just to make sure. The only thing you can do is make the explosion not nuclear, but just a conventional explosion by making sure that, you know, the nuclear explosive component doesn't escape the pit of the the nuclear bomb. So anyway, I had like four binders, you know, 1,000 pages each of research on the different types of nuclear weapons, plutonium versus uranium, and, you know, the long method, the short method. And I found it fascinating. There's no way in hell I could ever put, you know, even 1/1,000th of that information into the book, because it would have been like 9,700 pages, right? So what I did, I immersed myself in the material so well that I knew it so well that I could shorthand it and I could talk about it in a way that, you know, a layman would understand. And so those four binders became like two pages in the novel. And the way I set that up is I still was worried about whether, you know, I would lose a reader. So I had John Puller in the middle of this trying to defuse this nuclear weapon. I had his brother Bobby, who's an expert in this. And Bobby was instructing John Puller, you know, why and where, you know, whys and wherefores. Why are you doing this way? What do you have to do? What's the result going to be? In layman's terms. So what was I doing? I was actually having Bobby Puller explain to the reader through John Puller, this is why you're doing it, and this is the way it has to be, and this is what might happen. And that was another way, sort of as a safeguard, to make sure that the reader was not going to get lost in sort of this technical morass.
You're always thinking of the reader. The new book is Daylight. It's the latest Atlee Pine thriller. It's by David Baldacci. The book's available now everywhere. David, another fantastic offering for us to get a diversion from this pandemic and to enjoy, and thanks for joining us to talk about it.
Oh, thank you. I always enjoy it.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.